Next up on This Week in Law, I'm Denise Howell, and I'm going to be joined by Mike Keyes, my co-host, Derek Khanna, and Joe Bennett. We're going to talk about music copyright, copyright policy in general, and how that may be evolving with the regime change in Washington. We'll have some wonderful performances by Joe illustrating our discussion of recent music copyright cases. We'll look at a Trump work orange and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 369, recorded December 9th, 2016. Diddy goes to Washington. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. Happy holiday season. It's Denise Howell here, and we're about to do a very copyright and musically oriented episode of This Week in Law. One thing I love about doing this show every week is how we get to bring really smart people to you who are perhaps people you don't come across every single day of your life. And they get to talk at length and hopefully in depth and detail about really important issues and help you make up your mind about how you feel about those issues. And this week is no exception. We have a wonderful panel with us. Joining us for the first time on This Week in Law is Joe Bennett. He's the Dean and Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Boston Conservatory at Berkeley. He's the former Dean of Music and Performing Arts at Bath Spa University in the UK. He's also a guitar player and the former editor of Total Guitar magazine. Hi, Joe. It's great to meet you.
Great to meet you too, Denise. Really pleased to be here for the first time.
Thank you for joining us and returning to the show for, I think this is probably your third or fourth time on the show, Derek, although I have not taken inventory, is Derek Khanna. He's a lawyer and political commentator and columnist for such publications as Forbes, The Atlantic, The National Review, and many others. He worked toward the enactment of the Unlocking Consumer Choice and Wireless Competition Act in 2014. And he has been, are you still, Derek, a fellow at the Yale Information Society Project?
Sorry, I was previously affiliated with Yale, but no longer.
Gotcha. So it's just great to see you again. Good to hear you. Great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
Also joining me is my co-host, Mike Keyes, who is a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, Washington. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be with you as always. And this star-studded cast that we have, I'm super excited about today.
I know, me too. And for all you Emery Roan fans, co-host Emery is still having a very busy December. I don't think we're going to see him again until after the new year. So hello, Emery, in absentia, if you're watching the show, we miss you. And we'll see you soon. We hope you're having a great month. We're going to start out this show talking about copyright. We're going to talk a lot about music copyright specifically later on in the show and a bit in this segment of the show as well. But I wanted to start out on sort of a 10,000 foot level talking about the state of copyright law and getting more specific into Joe's expertise too, the state of music copyright law as we go through this sort of power and policy shift in the United States with the incoming administration. There is sort of a lot of speculation going on right now as to what President-elect Trump and his administration have as various positions on things like copyright reform, which is something that Derek has been writing about and advocating for quite some time, going back to 2013 and 2014, when I first stumbled on publications by him concerning what he calls constitutional copyright, and I'm sure others call it that too. I can call it that, which the intent of which is getting back to more of a founder's intent of how copyright law in the United States should work rather than the way it has evolved legislatively over time. So let's start our copyright discussion. I'd like to, Derek, by asking you what you think is going to happen next in the realm of copyright law in the United States. Are you reading the tea leaves at all? Do you think that scaling back the term of copyright, for example, is something that is even on the radar screen right now?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's two major paths that are going on right now that are going to affect copyright policy. One is the decisions going on in the House Judiciary Committee. And just this week, they put out their first proposal. It seems like every few weeks, they're going to be putting out a new proposal for discussion. And then the other question is what's going to be happening with a new Trump administration. And I don't think either of these are particularly predictable. But certainly, copyright terms don't necessarily seem like they're imminently on the horizon. But they also don't necessarily seem like they're going to be elongated anytime soon. So I'll chalk that up as one potential silver lining there. And as far as where Trump is going to be on intellectual property or his administration, it's interesting. You know, within the Republican, the GOP platform, there was a line about China stealing, quote, China is stealing our copyrights and our intellectual property, which I think intellectual property lawyers probably laughed at because there's a bunch of problems there. First of all, you know, China doesn't steal our copyrights. They're not breaking into the Library of Congress and stealing the registration forms. You know, what we're talking about is stealing copyrighted works. But that's like a little bit in the weeds, so we'll excuse it. But the second point is if you actually read the platform, you know, they're advocating for strong protection of intellectual property. And presumably that includes copyright. But yet they said China is stealing our copyrights and our intellectual property. As if they are separate things. So it seemed to demonstrate that there definitely wasn't a copyright lawyer on the team, I'll tell you that. And so where things go now, you know, Trump has made about 80% of his major cabinet level appointments, but he hasn't appointed the head of the USPTO. He hasn't named his science advisor. We really don't have that much information to go off of. What we do know is someone like Marsha Blackburn's been involved in the transition effort, and she's very much on one side of the copyright debate against what we would probably call reform. But I think it's a little bit too early to tell one way or the other. What we do know is that he was opposed to TPP, which was a pretty pro-IP treaty, but there's 100 reasons that one can be against TPP.
Right. So we are pretty certain at this juncture that TPP won't be enacted. How do you feel? What do you think is in the tea leaves for things like, I remember you pointing out back when you were writing about constitutional copyright a few years ago, the fact that the next copyright extension bill was expected, at least at that time, to come up in 2018, where we could go from life plus 70 to life plus 100, perhaps. Is that still on the calendar in that time frame?
You know, so far we've seen no real indications of that coming up, but I think that's something that a lot of copyright attorneys are nervously watching. But, you know, usually the groundwork for this stuff has to be laid a few years in advance. The impetus for listeners and viewers who don't remember is that Steamboat Willie, the Mickey Mouse franchise, will eventually enter the public domain, and so Congress has regularly re-upped copyright. But there are a few other things that have been going on that kind of give Disney more sway in this arena. You know, obviously they can use trademark law to protect the Disney character, and then there's been some decisions and going back and forth about how protected is a serialized format intellectual property where the first few episodes may fall out of copyright, but then you have 1,000 more movies that are within copyright. And it's not really a clear-cut case. You know, how you distinguish between the original Steamboat Willie and then future Mickey Mouse creations. So it's not like you're going to enter a world where, you know, all Mickey Mouse products are public domain. That's just not on the table.
So the way that music comes into our discussion of the evolution or reform of copyright law as we move forward with the new administration is the music industry and others have been busy penning letters to the president-elect, urging him to pay attention to certain issues, certain policy points as he goes forward. Google and various other technology-oriented entities, including the Internet Association, wrote a letter earlier in November outlining their policy priorities, things like, here's a quote from what they wrote, copyright policies must prioritize the public interest by protecting innovation and freedom of expression online, encouraging new forms of follow-on creative works, and ensuring users have access to legal content. Threats to the flexible framework, such as weakening limitations or exceptions to safe harbors, would create barriers to entry for internet startups and creators, which would deny users the ability to access content online. So we have those sorts of concerns being voiced. And recently, on November 29th, we had a letter from various folks in the music industry. Nile Rodgers, who's a songwriter and producer. We've got the Recording Academy President Neil Portnow, other members of the Recording Academy's National Advocacy Committee, talking in sort of general terms in their letter about the state of the music economy, the interests of all music creators, songwriters, performers, producers, engineers, and talking about copyright reform. But I have the feeling that the kind of copyright reform they have in mind might not be the same kind of copyright reform that others have in mind when they use that term. Joe, what's your take on this?
Well, yeah, I think the fascinating thing about the music industry is that it was one of the first, at least the recorded music industry, was one of the first IP-related industries to be really hit by the internet in copyright terms, simply because audio is the lowest bandwidth medium compared to, with the exception of text, of course. So now that we are in a streaming world, and for the first time significantly, I think it was last week, that streaming overtook download and other physical product revenue for the first time. So I think there's very little doubt that the future of the recorded music industry in terms of royalties generated is going to be in streaming. The question for the industry has been how to monetize it. But the reason I think that you have advocates like Rogers and others talking about potential reform is because of the two copyrights in music, you know, the musical work, which essentially is what pays songwriters through their publishers, and the sound recordings, which is what in old money, what record companies used to make. And because those were set up in copyright law at a time when those two concepts were very easily separated, you know, the songwriter effectively writes some sheet music and the record company makes a recording of it. We're now in this kind of strange limbo where the money to be made in terms of streaming is largely as a result of the major labels selling their back catalog through to streaming services such as Spotify. And the challenge is that the creators of the musical work, the songwriters, really don't have up-to-date mechanisms for getting paid. And as we know, the click-through or the dollars per click are so fractional and tiny that the way ASCAP and BMI work in the US to collect royalties is something that I think the advocates really want to be looked at with a view to an end goal of creators of musical works being more fairly remunerated. And the other part of what you said there, Denise, that I thought was really interesting was the idea of follow-on creative work. This is mm-hmm. another area that I don't want to say it hit the music industry first, but certainly it's we had to deal with it quite soon because of the invention of the hardware sampler in the 80s and 90s and the birth of hip-hop. And as I'm sure the you guys as legal experts know, there was a huge amount of case law in the early 90s and ongoing about sampling because copyright law just wasn't designed to deal with derivative musical works in quite that way, you know, incorporating another work. And now that we have YouTube and the mashup and the sort of a parody, well, what a plaintiff might call a parody loophole to enable some people to reuse others' work, there is, I think, perhaps quite a strong case for reform of some sort, just to acknowledge the fact that we live in an all digital world now and we have a lot of analog laws governing it.
Derek, do you agree that we're in a situation where copyright laws for such industries as the music industry, and they're not alone, the software industry would be another good example, aren't doing their job well enough for innovators and need to be examined, and that may well, we may well get more of a take on that from a Republican administration in Congress than we have been getting for the last 8 years?
So the light went off in my room, so I'm a little bit distracted.
Oh, we've got Derek in the dark.
I'll figure that out.
At least it's not a fire alarm.
not a fire alarm, right?
Yeah, you know what? You probably, I'm guessing you're on a motion sensor in there, and since you're not moving, it went off.
I wasn't moving enough, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of balancing acts that are going to have to, you know, be sorted out in a Trump administration. And I don't really think we have much of an indication one way or the other on how these things are going to really turn out.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just wait and see. Are you optimistic?
From my perspective of copyright reform, I am optimistic. We've had, administration after administration after administration that's been, you know, pro the Berne Convention, been pro Berne implementation, been pro copyright extension, been pro the DMCA, and so as far as I'm concerned, it really can't get that much worse. And so having somebody who's a little bit off the beaten path is generally going to be a good thing from my perspective. Particularly if it is a candidate who is more populist and more skeptical of kind of like the Hollywood inclination. But we kind of just have to wait and see if that's actually going to be the case.
Right. The other factor in the mix, of course, is the fact that at least, you know, as during the campaign and without lawyers on board to advise, we had confusion between what's a copyright and what's intellectual property law, and also in the mix, I think, is the fact that Donald Trump's background is as an owner of large businesses that rely, at least in some aspect, on their intellectual property, not to the extent that the music industry or the software industry would rely on those things. But I'm sure, you know, IP enforcement from a large business owner's perspective is something that the president-elect would be familiar with, and when he's talking about China stealing our copyrights, I think he's talking about it through that lens. Don't you agree, Derek?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, but the other side is, you know, I've written for Breitbart, and you know, Breitbart tends to be more skeptical of ingrained authority, and you know, they've been interested in patent reform and copyright reform, and skeptical of TPP, and so. It's kind of difficult to put one box on any of these things.
Right.
And I think in this case where you don't have a president who's really enunciated his policy, people become policy much more than ever before. So you're really going to have to watch who he appoints as head of USPTO and several other positions that involve intellectual property.
Okay. Well, thanks for the overview of copyright law and where we are and where we may be headed. Let's move into a discussion of how copyright law has been working recently in the music industry and go through with Joe a number of the music copying cases that hopefully folks who've been watching and listening to the show are already familiar with because we've touched on them in the past. So there have been a lot of cases, and we've discussed a number of them on the show. So you may feel like you've been seeing a lot of instances lately where somebody has come into court and sued over music or a bit of music that they feel is similar to something that they authored that is being performed by distributed by other musicians. And going back to the Blurred Lines case, Alan Thicke and the estate of Marvin Gaye, where the estate of Gaye was successful in that case, it seems like we've seen a lot along those lines. And we've discussed recently, too, the Stairway to Heaven case versus Taurus. So I think, Mike, you wanted to give us some overview about how copyright works in these cases, because it gets kind of complicated.
Sure. It is complicated. I think music copyright is probably the most complicated or intricate area of copyright law, or at least arguably so. So a couple of points that I think will be important as we continue to have the discussion with Joe and Derek is, when it comes to enforcement of copyright in the U.S., in order to enforce your copyright, you have to have a certificate of registration. You have to register that work with the Copyright Office, which is set up in the Library of Congress. And when it comes to music, musical works, we're really talking about two distinct types of works, if you will. There's the sheet music that's written on the page in notation, and it could include lyrics or maybe it doesn't have lyrics, but that's really a distinct work of authorship in the music copyright world. So we've got that issue. You also have what are referred to in the law as sound recordings, which is the fixation of musical sounds embodied in some sort of device where they can be perceived, you know, on a CD or maybe it's even stored digitally. So the sounds that make up a musical work, that's a distinct musical work that's protected under copyright. So that's going to come into play probably in our discussion when we talk about certainly the Stairway case and probably the Blurred Lines case as well. Another important concept when it comes to music copyright protection is, even once you have a certificate of registration, meaning that you've protected your piece of sheet music or you've protected your sound recording, copyright protection doesn't extend to that entire work necessarily. If you've incorporated typical stock types of musical phrases, those would not be protected by copyright. It's called sans affaire. We've talked about that before a little bit. But typical musical compositional techniques aren't protected by copyright or wouldn't be part of the copyright protection for that particular musical work at issue. And also, if there's unoriginal pieces, if you've incorporated somebody else's musical work or other work into your composition, that obviously wouldn't be protected either. And then ultimately, the legal question here that judges and juries are called to decide is whether the two works are substantially similar, whether the alleged copyist has taken protectable elements from the plaintiff's work. So with that framework, I think that's going to help give a little bit more context to our discussion today.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Joe, as Mike was just hitting those points, it occurs to me that a lot of this analysis is purely the province of the lawyers and not the province of the creators. That as you're writing a piece of music, you're not saying, oh, I'm using a stock musical phrase right now, and so I know that this part of my song is not protectable, or I'm sampling something by someone else. You might know enough as a musician to know I'm going to probably have to clear rights in that. Or you might just forge ahead and say, I like it, and so I'm incorporating it in my work, whether you're flat out sampling it or duplicating it in one way or another in the music that you are writing. Am I correct about that?
Well, certainly that's been borne out in my own academic research. My academic research previously involved quite a lot of deep interviews with creators of music, and particularly collaborative songwriters, essentially asking the question about the psychology of the creative process. You know, how do you make works? What happens when you go into a room and then 3 hours later there is a song that didn't exist before? And what are the specific processes you go through in order to make that, in this case, musical work? But in terms of reuse of material, as a music teacher and as a teacher of popular music and songwriting, this is a question that has been that my students have asked me throughout my career, which is, how much can I copy? And according to the law, how much can I copy? That is, how many seconds sampling, which obviously is, as Mike summarized excellently there, is copying of the sound recording. And to, simplified in musical terms, how many notes of the melody am I allowed to take? Now, as you guys know, the answer is always substantial similarity, and substantial is an adjective that is applied on a literally case-by-case basis. So whenever my students ask me how much can I sample in my work, I say, I think it's fair to say, even as a foreigner, I can say I agree with the Sixth Circuit, which is none at all. If you take any work from any prior sound recording, and however much you manipulate it, however much you reappropriate it, and in terms of balance, however much new creative content you add in your new derivative work, does not affect the extent of substantiality. So the challenge really, although there's so many challenges, as Mike said, but I think one of the main ones is the way the creative process has changed over the last 30 years or so for songwriters, and certainly changed very significantly since the 70s. And the Blurred Lines case was a good example of this, because the certificate of registration, the Copyright Office, in that case, as we know, registered the sheet music. And in creative terms, songwriters very often don't use sheet music. They're not traditional classical composers in that way. They often compose straight to tape or straight to computer, as it is now, which means that while creating a musical work, in many cases, they're also simultaneously creating a sound recording. And from the creator's perspective, the musical and creative gestures that you might undertake are very difficult to pull apart. So when we... But for example, the transcription that was filed with the Copyright Office for Blurred Lines, which I think that must have been filed sometime around the release of the record, which is 77, that wasn't done by Marvin Gaye, nor was it... this is the transcription of the song Got to Give It Up. Nor was the song ever written in that way in the first place. You can hear... just from the recording, that this is clearly a bunch of musicians jamming in the studio with a sort of melodic framework that the singer has established. So my understanding is that, and disclosure, I wasn't involved in the Blurred Lines case, so I can talk freely about it. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the judge did not allow the sound recordings to be played in court, and instead relied purely on the musicologist's interpretations and presumably performances of those works. But the challenge is, where does a musical work end and a sound recording begin? It's really easy to define what a sound recording is. It's either a physical artifact, such as a CD, or it's a digital audio file. And of course, all a CD is one great big digital audio file on a plastic medium. But the sound recording... the sound recording itself is really quite easy to detect copying. You know, when I'm called on to consultative cases where there's an accusation of sampling, I've got a whole bunch of technical tools that make it really fairly straightforward to detect the sample in the defendant's work if it's there. But and I don't know if I'm using the word loophole technically correctly in a legal sense here, but I certainly perceive it as a loophole, is that what happens when you imitate, using humans and studio techniques, when you imitate the properties of a sound recording but don't copy the composition? Now, this is the bread and butter of the TV ad music industry. The story goes something like this. The ad agency... pitches to their client, let's say it's a car manufacturer, and they say, we want, I don't know, let's choose a track at random. We want the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations under this car ad. And they contact, the ad agency puts it under there. The client falls in love with the initial rushes of the video of the ad and says, great, let's go ahead. The ad agency contacts the record label that owns the sound recording of Good Vibrations and tries to license it, also contacts the publisher so that they can license the musical work. And either one or other of them says no, or the cost of licensing that track is prohibitively expensive for the client. So the ad agency goes to a music sound-alike company and says, we want something that feels a little bit like Good Vibrations and we want it to go under our car ad. And the music company goes, right. And what they do is they sail through the pillars of copyright. Can you sail through a pillar? they navigate the constraints of copyright. So, and I've done a few sound-alike things like this myself, and I know a lot of people who have, a lot of musicians who have. The brief is always the same. Make it sound like the reference track. Don't copy any notes, because that's very much how a lot of case law defines the musical work. But copy whatever production values and vocal stylings or whatever that you like. So you end up with a track that sounds a bit like the Beach Boys and not quite like Good Vibrations, a sort of a pastiche work. So what really are you imitating when you make that new, arguably new musical work? It's certainly a derivative work, but you're not copying the musical work in terms of the notes, the lyrics, and the underlying chords. But you're copying all of the production values, the reverb times, the equalization on the drum sound, the whatever it is, retro vibe of the production. And if you're doing that, in legal terms, the question I think is, what really are you copying? You're definitely copying something from one specific work, but you are arguably copying something that is not itself protected by copyright. Like, you know, a production value, the use of a particular instrument.
Yeah, that's right. Joe, that's interesting. I mean, you mentioned a derivative work. I would think there would be an argument that in that context, you've under copyright, of course, under U.S. copyright, the copyright owner has the exclusive right to authorize derivative works, works derived from the original. So in that context, the ad agency might run afoul of the derivative work right potentially. Another way that a band like the Beach Boys could enforce, it wouldn't be a copyright claim, but we've seen this in a couple of different instances over the years. Brian Wilson could claim that maybe you haven't copied the music, but you have if it sounds enough like the Beach Boys or like Brian Wilson, he could say that's a violation of his right of publicity. We saw that in a case a number of years ago involving Bette Midler. The Ford Motor Company allegedly created an ad that sounded like her voice. So we've seen that over the years. It's not a copyright claim, but it's a right of publicity claim.
Yeah, that's a great example, the Bette Midler one. I believe there was also a similar one with Tom Waits, where someone had basically used an impersonator. That's a great example. And as you say, they had to sidestep copyright law because it wasn't the musical work that's being that was being infringed, or arguably it wasn't. And this is the answer that non-legal specialists, creative musicians want to try and get from the law, which is, what can I copy? A case I was looking at recently, one of the many Bridgeport Music UMG ones, which is the George Clinton song Atomic Dog, where the object that was registered with the Copyright Office was the recording. So the court was able, I believe, to infer that the musical work was embodied in that recording. So when someone went and did very much what I'm describing, an imitative copy of some of the musical elements, but not the musical notes, they were able to say that some of the musical gestures were in fact copied, because the musical work was a different one. You know, it was actually the expression of the musical work, the abstract concept of the musical work, existed in a recording that had been filed with the Copyright Office.
Okay, I think the studio actually has a clip of this ready to play for comparison, if that makes sense now, Joe. Should we do that?
Great, let's hear it.
All right.
So you're listening for the rhythmic panting and the word dog.
Rhythmic dog, harmonic dog, house dog, street dog, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs.
Keep it playing.
Yeah, kind dog, funky dogs, nasty dogs.
Okay, so yes. In that particular case, the things that were protected in the musical work were the attitudinal vocal dog and the rhythmic panting, basically functioning like a hi-hat would in a drum part. And then the infringing work, as it was found to be, was from a band called Public Announcement, and the track was called D.O.G. and Me. I don't know if we have a clip in that. So you're listening for the panting and the word dog.
Do we have that, Victor?
Do we have that clip?
Here we go.
Get some loving, and I'm loving you too. Ladies, make no mistake, y'all can never pull my whole car. Y'all don't want me claim my stake in another yard. I'm a dog.
Tell me what makes a man wanna play hard when he needs to cry.
Yeah, that's cool. And tell me
what time. I'm so glad that we had those to play, because if I were on a jury and someone were telling me, okay, we're suing for copyright for substantial similarities between these works, my initial response would be no, there's no infringement here. and I think that are we getting perhaps to a point with copyright law, Joe, where the Blurred Lines case being an example, the Led Zeppelin case being another, where we're starting to see the law being used too aggressively?
I think so, because there isn't a theory of the psychology of creativity created by a theorist called Arthur Koestler in the 1960s, and it's the theory of bisociation. Put simply, everything is a mashup of everything else. And it goes back to the ancient Greeks, Aristotle, nothing can come from nothing. The idea is that all music is in some way derivative of music that's gone before, and pop music is an evolved art form. So I think the Blurred Lines case kind of frightened a lot of musicians, because anyone with any kind of musical training or anyone who's ever written a song or played a cover version could hear very obviously that these were different songs. Mm-hmm. And yet they shared certain characteristics. What the Gaze Estates family estate musicologist called a constellation of coincidences of non-protectable elements. So specifically in the case of Blurred Lines, they were a cowbell riff, a rhythmic cowbell playing all the way through both tracks, playing the bass line on an electric piano, having a falsetto male vocal, having party noises in the background, and curiously, not having a guitar was claimed to be a creative decision by Marvin Gaye that was later copied. Allegedly,
wow.
Because it's not genre typical. So the absence of something was argued to be a copyrightable thing in some strange world. So I do think that particular case worried a lot of people, which is in the music industry, because it was so obviously not a copy, it was influenced. And because yourself, whenever you read a Rolling Stone interview with your favorite artist, they always talk about their influences, and that's kind of part of the evolution of music and how we move the art form forward. So the idea that you couldn't even do something that was stylistically based on an artist you admired, very much as Robin Thicke testified in the case, it's an alarming one for a lot of musicians.
Well, I think it's alarming if we get back to the policy aspects of copyright law for a moment. I think it's alarming for people who have watched the development of the law over the years. Derek, I'm wondering, getting back to your notion of constitutional copyright, how you think the founders would grapple with an issue like this.
Well, it's not just the founders. It's the doctrine that they sought to embody in the Constitution and the early case law and what the British thought of what copyright was designed to be. Mm-hmm. Up through the 19th century, copyright infringement required the wholesale replication of an existing work. And in fact, in the early United States, it didn't apply to the vast majority of books because they were from Britain and those books didn't even qualify for copyright. And so we've entered a world now where any kind of externality of that copyrighted work, somebody thinks that they should get a royalty check for, and that's one argument, but that's just not even close to the same thing that the founders or the British were talking about when they wrote the copyright clause. And the idea that every externality needs to be recaptured is an illogical one. It's just impossible. Somebody is performing his violin outside of my restaurant and he demands to get a payment for that. Well, that may benefit my restaurant, but he's choosing to perform on his own volition. Comedians steal from one another. Fashion designers steal designs from one another. Chefs create incredible new recipes, and other chefs borrow from that. So this idea that all externalities are to be recaptured is one that is only really argued in the copyright industry. So it's inherently a balancing act that we have to decide upon. And when we know from artists themselves that this is how the creative process works, you could see a world of infinite propertization, and it really looks crazy, right? The first person who has the first rock album, no other artist is allowed to have a rock album because they're inspired by that original rock album. That's not what we want. That's not what the artists themselves want. And in fact, the data even shows that when you're sampled by other artists, it's minimal data, but we have one study on this, that it likely increases your sales. And it's usually the best thing to ever happen to you is when you're sampled. So it's really what's going on here is it's kind of borrowing from European rhetoric about moral rights, that you have some sort of a moral interest in that work perpetually. But that's just not what the system at the American the Constitution embodies.
And this is what I was getting at when I mentioned earlier. I don't think that the Recording Academy and the signatories to the letter to the president-elect on behalf of songwriters, performers, producers, and engineers, I don't think that they were, they seem to be more concerned with royalties than with the creative process, because the point they call out is music lovers have more ways to listen to music than ever before, but the laws governing the sale and distribution of music have failed to keep pace with technology, keeping music creators from receiving fair market value for their work. What they don't mention at all is the laws not keeping pace with or being applied in ways that impinge the creative process itself. And I think that's what we're kind of getting at here with these music copying cases.
Kind of curious. I mean, those letters come out every 6 months or so. They're circulated by the MPAA and they have, or sorry, the RAA, and they have, big artist names on them. But they're always about not getting enough royalty money, but it's always written by the people who are getting the most royalty money. And they're never really talking about the creative process or what it's like to sample from one artist to another. And I'll just give you an example, which is that if you're trying to create a song, which is like a Puff Daddy, I'll Be Missing You in the 1990s, he wanted to sample from Sting. And it's widely believed that Sting said, if you want to sample and reuse that work for I'll Be Missing You, I'm going to require 100% of your revenue. And you can do that, right? You can be an artist and you could say it's 100% of revenue, or you can say it's 50% of revenue and you need two samples, so it's 100% of your revenue, or it could be three artists and it's 150% of revenue. That's the system that we have now. And as a result, we have a lot of artists like Public Enemy who has publicly said they stopped making music because they could not make the type of music that they were making. But you never see that reflected in these letters. And I think both things are important. We want artists to be well compensated, but we want the artistic process to be able to continue.
I think we can all agree on that. What I think is the mystery here is how we get to a place where artists are compensated in the way they claim is necessary to pay attention to in the letters that you're referring to, Derek, and that the creative process is protected and recognizes what's happening, not just compositionally, but technologically in the music industry. There's so much changing in the music industry so rapidly. There's some great posts on Joe's website that we're going to talk about in a little while here, highlighting some of the ways that technology is altering the music industry. But before we get to those specific examples, I guess I just want to ask all of you, how do we fix this? What do you think, Mike?
easy
that's question a huge, for the day.
Yeah, that's a huge question. You know, it's such a multifaceted issue. And as I mentioned at the outset of the show, I mean, I think that music copyright is probably the most complex and most complicated area of the law when it comes to copyright. I think there's certainly a very sound argument to be made that copyright has expanded so incredibly far outside of its original intent. As Derek was mentioning, you know, the first Copyright Act enacted by Congress, I'm pretty certain that it didn't even protect musical works. I think that came about.
That's correct,
music became protected, I want to say, in like the 1830s when there was an amendment to the copyright statute. And of course, sound recordings didn't even exist back in the 1790s or even in the 1800s when music was finally protected. So, mm-hmm. You know, we've gotten to the point where millions of dollars are being expended on cases involving the sampling of, you know, less than a second worth of music. You know, the Madonna En Vogue case that was recently decided by the Ninth Circuit is a really good example of that. I think, you know, it makes sense to re-examine this area and have we really gone too far here? I argued years ago, and I know we're probably nowhere close to this happening, but to me, it would make sense to have some sort of compulsory license system that's going to allow people to use musical snippets from prior works for some sort of modest royalty. I'm not sure that that's ultimately a workable solution, but it seems to me that this is endemic to the art form. You know, as Joe had mentioned, you know, a lot of musical inspiration comes from pre-existing works. I mean, look at, for example, works of any of the great classical composers, Bach, Beethoven, Haydn. I mean, they all copied from each other and, you know, created these incredible works that have endured over many centuries. You know, our own Star Spangled Banner, for example, the music to that, that's not something that was made here in America by an American composer. That's actually an old English song that was borrowed. To Anchronon in Heaven is the name of that original English tune. So, you know, I think you could look, and Joe would certainly know better than I, but you look throughout the course of history, there is a healthy amount of copying particularly with this art form. And I think that should be respected and taken into consideration in any sort of modification that's going to be made to the Copyright Act. So that's I'll step down from my soapbox now.
That was a great answer, by the way. Joe, do you have any suggestions as to how the situation is capable of being aided in the future, or should we just look forward to more lawsuits on more discrete parts of songs?
It's bizarre that we're trying to settle this whole thing case by case through the courts. Just as a musician and a creator, I'd really like to live in Mike's world of compulsory rights and pay a royalty, because you know, it, a lot of the time, musicians would be happy to pay that royalty. Of course, you'd then end up over time getting derivative works of derivative works, and there's a lot of arithmetic to be done of who owns what percentage of what. But I really do like the idea of that. I think there are two specific things the law could do, and you know, I should just caveat what I'm about to say with the fact that I've only been in the US a year and a half. So mm-hmm. I'm still learning quite a lot about US law and specific US case law as opposed to European law. And Mike mentioned moral rights as an example of something mm-hmm. Europe has that the US doesn't in the same way. But specific things that I think US case law could do, sorry, US copyright law could do, and I'm going to use Blade Lines as an example. Mm-hmm. A lot of musicians, as we know from the amicus brief that was filed a few months ago about Blurred Lines, a lot of musicians thought no notes have been copied, therefore it's not a copy. And yet, I think there's an argument that it was an intentional copy, that the Blurred Lines was an intentional copy. You've got to give it up. It copied a bunch of elements that hadn't been combined in that way. So my first utopian law would be to expand the definition of a musical work to be everything that we hear, which, so you don't just have to have mechanical reproduction of a sound recording to infringe a copyright. Everything could be protected. So a pant, the sound dogue, as the George Clinton example showed us. But at the same time, I think we should try and raise the threshold of substantiality. That is, you should be able to get away with copying more, with or without paying a royalty. You know, that's maybe something for the industry to contribute to. So two mm-hmm. things, really. Expand the definition of a musical work beyond the notes, because that represents what creators are doing now. People compose straight to computer in many cases. And secondly, to raise the threshold of substantiality, certainly beyond 1 second of sampling, to mm-hmm. to allow people to use more borrowing in their work, and if necessary compensate the original owners. But certainly the idea that the original copyright holder can just demand that something is taken down. I think it was Derek mentioned the Every Breath You Take example, and I'll Be Missing You. I will just take a moment to talk about that, because although it wasn't a case, it was just a business deal, as Derek said, it was quite widely reported. I've got a guitar here, which I'm just going to use to demonstrate my point.
Please.
So the riff in question, for those who know the 1997 track, or even for those who know the Police track, the original 80s track, Every Breath You Take, is this guitar riff, 8-bar guitar riff. Ran out of breath at the end there. So it's eight bars of music, and it was sampled in its as the entire guitar accompaniment. That's from the original Police record, Every Breath You Take. And it was used in the Puff Daddy hit I'll Be Missing You as accompaniment for the chorus, and indeed throughout the song. That those eight bars just looped throughout the song. And yet lyrics were changed, new material was added. But as Derek was saying, they approached Sting as the creator of the musical work. Presumably they licensed the sample as well, but approached Sting as the creator of the musical work, saying that they wanted to use it. And they and the response was, yes, but we want 100% of those royalties. So in terms of moral rights, Sting is now co-credited as a composer of that, but more significantly receives 100% of the royalties, even though the later work added a lot of new creative material. And the interesting thing about the Every Breath You Take riff is that the chords, the underlying harmony, so we've got that very distinctive Andy Summers guitar riff with that sort of muting thing going on. The actual chords, A, F sharp minor, D, E, and back to A, are the chords of many songs. For example, Benny King's Stand By Me. The chords are actually the same. It's a fun party trick. You can try singing Stand By Me along to Every Breath You Take at some point. And of course, so that is an example, at least in harmonic terms, in chord terms, of a commonplace work that was not original at the time of Every Breath You Take. So I keep coming back to this musical question. What exactly has been copied? And until musicians and hopefully copyright law is willing to... has some way to define what it is that is protected in a musical work, we're going to end up with everyone going after these big hits in the way that we're seeing in recent case law.
Right. So I'm going to go ahead and put a passphrase into the show in case you are watching or listening for MCLE or other professional credit. And the phrase is, "While my guitar gently weeps." Derek, you're the closest thing we have to a Washington insider on the show today. You've worked in Congress. You've studied copyright law from the policy perspective. We've had a couple of good suggestions here from Joe and Mike: compulsory licensing, the expanding of how much may be copied, in addition to copyrightability of things that might not be considered copyrightable now. They all seem like good ideas. What's your take on the ability of those kinds of approaches to actually get incorporated into our law?
Well, first, I have a preferred alternative to the mandatory licensing system that I've written up before. But you know, all these things would probably be a step in the right direction to provide more certainty to the content creators. But the sad reality is, and I can tell you this for a fact because I worked for a while on these issues, I can only think of one registered lobbyist that works on copyright reform, maybe two. Mm-hmm. Whereas the RIA, MPA, Chamber of Commerce, and Disney have hundreds. And that makes a big difference. Almost every technology company that works on copyright issues, they say, well, we're not talking about term limits. We're not talking about statutory damages. We're not talking about DMCA Section 1201. Our only issue is X, Y, and Z. So there's really no one advocating in Washington, in my opinion, in a credible way on real copyright reform, aside from maybe a public knowledge. And the issue there is that, in particular, none of them are articulating this for a conservative audience or for Republicans. None of them have really invested in how to talk to Republicans or conservatives. So over the past 5 years, group by group has been bought off by the other side. So you want me to game plan out the new prospects? No one has talked on to the conservative audiences. So do I think that the Republicans are going to pick up the banner in a positive direction? It's going to take time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we at least have a good framework for what may be necessary. Yeah, exactly. Mike, before we leave this topic of the recent music cases, do you have any further questions for Joe or anything more you wanted to shade this with or discuss?
Well, were we going to also talk about the Stairway to Heaven case in this segment, or are we going to move?
Let's do it.
Because as we, I first heard Joe on NPR when he was interviewed by Scott Simon this summer, and he was discussing the Stairway to Heaven case, which at that point had not, we had not received a jury verdict on. We now have, and of course it was found that, that Led Zeppelin did not infringe on the Taurus spirit number. So I think it'd be great to talk about that for a few moments. And, you know, I know Joe did played some musical snippets from the case. And also, Joe, as I recall, you had played a couple of pre-existing works showing where that particular bass riff came from.
Sure.
I guess before you launch into it, Joe, I have a further sort of shading question to this. If you could, in your discussion, help us understand what went right for Led Zeppelin that did not go right for Thick in the Blurred Lines case.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, great question. Yeah. I'm glad that we've got here to a discussion of commonplace elements, because a huge amount of my work in analyzing music for clients relates to commonplace elements. So just before we launch the Stairway, I'll give you a quick example. Every year I get maybe five or six songwriters approach me, ask me to write a report on their work because they believe that the hit that they just heard on the radio was taken from their indie song released some years before. I get cases like this all the time. And in many cases, I take a very quick listen and simply politely decline the commission, because what the person is hearing is commonplace elements. And Denise, you said earlier, if I were a juror, you know, and this is the, I think, the challenge that the US system has, because it uses juries in infringement cases, that it, although it uses experts as well, the role of the expert is to pull apart the musical work and the sound recording. The role of the juror is to be the regular listener, the sort of innocent ear on the work.
Can I go down the rabbit hole before we go a bit further? Yeah, yeah. In the UK, juries don't get involved in this process at all?
Not usually, although very few cases are tried in the UK. Certainly the little bit of case law I've been involved in was the judge and the legal professionals and the plaintiff and defendant only, and the experts, mm-hmm. of course. But yeah, in the US, juries are much more common. And I think that's the challenge, because how do you instruct a jury how to listen to a piece of music? Phenomenologically, the act of listening to music is a deeply personal thing, and we can mm-hmm. never know what another person hears and how they hear it.
Right.
So, and this is, so I will now get to the point of Stairway. Commonplace elements, as we know, are very common in music. So a straightforward example would be one of the current most common chord loops is chord 6, chord 4, chord 1, chord 5, right? And so in the case of the guitar that I'm holding now, that's a chord of A minor, F, C, G. Now, that chord loop is a whole lot of songs. It's a commonplace element. It's a building block of song that, you know, round about now, it's possible that something like 40% of the four of the top 10 songs may well include that loop. I haven't done this week's analysis, but it's not uncommon. So I'll give you a few examples. Complicated by Avril Lavigne. Why'd I have to go and make things so complicated? Or till now, I always got time on my own. I'll catch a grenade for you, Bruno Mars. Or can't do it up that high. Hello from the other side. So those four chords mm-hmm. are something that's in commonplace used by songwriters. So what the Stairway to Heaven case really hinged on was whether Stairway to Heaven itself, as a musical work, used original musical ideas in it. But this is why the jury was so significant. So and to illustrate, before I talk any more about it, I'll just play you Stairway to Heaven. And I'm going to try and get the guitar into camera so you can see specifically. Let me just try and move along a little. Can you see my fingers there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm up here at the seventh fret of the guitar, which is where Stairway to Heaven riff is played. And here's the Stairway to Heaven that every nerd in a guitar shop learns. The whole sequence. And I want you to watch this string as this descending one fret at a time line can be heard. And then you get the arpeggio on top. So here's Stairway to Heaven. That's the whole of Stairway to Heaven, which is 1971. So a couple of years earlier, this is the earlier work. This is the intro of Taurus. Now, like all of us, when we hear those back-to-back, we think they sound pretty similar. And the challenge for a jury in a court environment is why do they sound pretty similar? What musically is going on that makes them sound similar? And I think one of the most obvious things that's likely to be is that descending line. But it's also, what we also perceive as sort of psychologically a similarity is the fact that I am playing them both on a guitar and they both begin at the 7th fret of the guitar. I could play that note at the 12th fret or the 2nd fret and it would sound subtly different. So we're hearing a bunch of very subtle messages from the instrumentation of the guitar that are to do with the performance and not the composition. So one of the US late night talk show hosts, forget which one it was it Trevor Noah, one of them, said at the time of the Stairway to Heaven case, when they played those examples back to back, referring to Led Zeppelin, he said, "They're screwed," and the audience all laughed. Because, of course, they did sound very similar, as they do to any lay listener. The challenge in the Stairway to Heaven case, and thankfully, I think the court absolutely and the jury made the right decision, is that there were a whole bunch of musical works going back hundreds of years that used that chromatic descending idea. So the court successfully stripped out the subjective similarity caused by playing the thing at the 7th fret on a guitar and descending one fret at a time. And my favorite example of the many that were given at the time is My Funny Valentine's, is a very well-known song, a jazz standard from 1937, which contains the same descending chord sequence. And I'll try and sing it in my rough baritone with Stairway to Heaven on top. So, My Funny Valentine, Sweet Comic Valentine, and so on. So you get the idea that it was a commonplace element in use by lots of songwriters, and therefore Taurus itself was not an original user of that musical idea, and nor was Stairway to Heaven. So in the case of Taurus, there was no copyright to protect.
Absolutely. That's the answer I was looking for. So in the difference between those two cases is there were copyrightable elements in the Blurred Line case, and in the Stairway to Heaven case, even the work in question that was being sued over, they found that those riffs that you just so wonderfully demonstrated for us, Joe, that whole body of work was not copyrightable. Am I getting that right?
That's right, or the particular excerpt that was covered. Yeah. Of course, there's lots in Stairway to Heaven, the longer work, sorry, in Taurus, the longer work, that is is protected by copyright. But the section they took was not that. But the problem with Blurred Lines is that it was just confusing for musicians. Although, from what I hear of the reporting of the case, Robin Thicke wasn't a particularly likable or sympathetic witness. And there are those who have speculated that the jury took against him for non-copyright related reasons.
Right.
Yeah, I think that brings up a really interesting point, Joe, contrasting Blurred Lines to Stairway to Heaven. So something that struck me, and I don't know if it struck the jurors in the Stairway case, but here you've got, as you mentioned, Stairway to Heaven was written back in 1971, and the case is being brought in 2015, heard by a jury in 2016. I got to think they're thinking, why is this now just happening, 40 plus years after it was written, after it's been one of the most iconic, famous songs in the history of the world of rock? Why now is the plaintiff just bringing this case? Of course, plaintiff was able to bring the case because of a Supreme Court ruling that dealt away with a body of law called laches, meaning unreasonable delay. But I still think, kind of reading tea leaves and speculating wildly here, that had to figure in somehow into the jury's verdict. Like, this just doesn't seem right. And you also pointed out in the Blurred Lines case that Alan Thicke didn't necessarily make or Robin Thicke, rather. I think Alan's his dad. in any event, that he didn't make a very sympathetic witness. As I recall, I wasn't there in the courtroom at the time, but I recall reading from the at various points during the trial that I think he had admitted that he and his co-writer wanted to come up with something that sounded something like Marvin Gaye's smash hit from the 70s. But then on the stand, he said something like, well, when I said that to the press, I was like not thinking, or maybe I was, you know, intoxicated or something. So he may have been, as you said, punished for non-copyright reasons. Maybe they didn't like him and they thought it sounded close enough. And, you know, the vagaries of the jury system, I suppose.
Absolutely. And that particular interview, I think I'm quoting exactly when he said, Farrell and I were listening to Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye. And I said, damn, we should write something like that, something with that vibe. And you should, and from a musician's point of view, why not? You know, musicians should be able to say that, be inspired by a piece of music and go in the studio and feel inspired and then create something new. And I would suggest on a musically creative level, whether or not he's likable, I think that's exactly what they did. But yeah, that didn't help him, obviously, in the case, because he had specifically named Got to Give It Up as a work that had influenced him in Blurred Lines. So there was no getting away from it. And that it seems to me, as a non-lawyer, a fairly weak defense to say I was a bit off my face at the time.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a break for a moment here and thank our first sponsor for this episode, our one sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. That's obviously a very good thing. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. You can also set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Turn your smartphone into your business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's move on from there to something else within the realm of music. I wanted to highlight for folks, we've been talking about changes to the law that would enable more creative music composition and more use of other works, more building on other works. And what we haven't really brought into this is the way that technology and the application of law to technology impacts the whole ecosystem. And I think that this example begins to bring that to the fore. It is a video, sort of a sardonic political commentary video that was posted called A Trump Work Orange. So I think that we have it available to watch. It's not very long. If it's queued up, Victor, let's play a bit of that. We need the audio. There we go. So, as you can see, funny video incorporating sped up clips of President-elect Trump and others. William Tell Overture in the background and an overlay of A Clockwork Orange, I guess a reference to the incoming president's hair color and maybe other things in A Clockwork Orange. So I think this is just a great video to consider from the various intellectual property issues you could pull from it, whether it's the logos of A Clockwork Orange, et cetera. But what seems to be problematic here is the fact that there is a DMCA battle going on and now a lawsuit over this video between its creator and the creators, or the rights holders at any rate, of the musical compositions used in A Clockwork Orange. The people suing here are called Serendip LLC. They represent A Clockwork Orange's composer, Wendy Carlos, who I guess did that sound recording of the William Tell overture. And it's the musical track here that is the thorny point, although there were probably other things that we could talk about from the IP perspective with that particular sardonic commentary piece. There was the usual DMCA back and forth about it. The creator of the video, Hugh Atkin, responded to the takedown notice, counter-noticed, and said, I don't know, I haven't read that notice, but I assume he said, no, this is fair use. And now there is a lawsuit pending, and the lawsuit is over use of the William Tell overture track. So I thought this was just interesting to show and toss out in the context of our discussion, because even if the creator here, Hugh Atkin, is right, the way that systems have been designed in order to protect Google and YouTube and other video providers online, distributors online, is the way the DMCA works. They have to take this down because of the use of the music and the complaint of the folks who have now sued. So I just wanted to toss this out to the panel and see what they think of it all. Derek, we'll start with you.
So if I understand correctly, the composition itself is public domain, but the performance was not. Is that correct?
I that's what I'm gleaning from this, yes.
Yes, right, just so for info, yes, the William Tell Overture was written in 1829 by Rossini.
I figured that.
And is well out of copyright as a musical work, but the sound recording, mm-hmm. Wendy Carlos is a largely synthesizer-based artist who did the soundtrack of Clockwork Orange and was very active in the 60s and 70s.
So the first thing is a little bit sloppy. You probably could have found a public domain version of that, or Creative Commons version of that. But we've seen this come up quite a lot, where creators have wanted their work taken off of political commercials or political videos, and it's an increasing problem. And I think the audio really adds something to the experience and to the political speech. And so do we really want to live in a world where every audio creator is able to just say no when it's a completely separate creation? And, a major point of art over the years has been to foster political communication. I'm reminded of the Dr. Seuss estate being very litigious and scaring off anti-abortion demonstrators. And the anti-abortion demonstrators, they wanted to hold up a placard that said a person is a person no matter how small. And the Dr. Seuss estate says, no, that's a copyrighted phrase. You can't use that. And so I don't think we have necessarily clear resolution of the matter, but I would definitely lean towards saying that we should make this kind of more of a blanket fair use example.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good point you raised, too, about especially if you're going to use a work that's in the public domain, why not take advantage of that? But it may just be that the creator either wanted to make the point of actually using the track from the movie to really drive home the point of the dystopian, terrible world portrayed in that movie, perhaps, or maybe just, as you said, was sloppy and didn't go out and find a public domain track that could have conveyed the same mood. Joe, what are your thoughts?
Well, William Tell Overture is obviously a public domain work, and yes, we might say that that creator should have gone out and found a different orchestral recording of William Tell Overture, although of course most orchestral recordings are likely to be protected by sound recording copyright to this day.
Yes.
So I had a case that I worked on Naxos v. Salmon in the UK in 2012, where the work was the Vivaldi's Four Seasons. So there was no question of copyright infringement of a musical work, but it was about the particular Naxos sound recording that had been copied. It actually might have been, just as an observation practically, it might have been quite difficult for that creator, even if he or she had been willing, to find a public domain recording of the William Tell overture, because it's an orchestral work. It's not something one can easily recreate.
And Mike, getting back to the question of how YouTube and other video sharing sites have to operate as a practical matter, because of the volume of material that's getting uploaded to them and the fact that they have to respond to takedown notices. Folks have been saying all along, as we've been recording this show with Joe's great recreation of various elements of the music we've been talking about today,
please tell me that's fair use. Is it, Denise?
Fair use has a posse, Joe. What we're doing here is commentary and should very much be fair use. But the way that things work on the YouTube side is this will get posted and perhaps, you know, the content ID system will flag it because of the music clips in the show. And we may have to go to bat on it. And, you know, is that the world we should be in, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, it's problematic. I mean, we've talked about it before. I tend to think that, until something better comes along, I'm generally in favor of the DMCA process. It's not perfect by any means. I'm just not certain what the better alternative is here. I think with respect to a Trump work, Orange, I am troubled by this particular takedown notice because, as Joe and Derek pointed out, I mean, the William Tell Overture is long since been in the public domain. And so I'm not And the sound recording itself, as I understand it, and as I recall from the movie that I saw years ago, and I'm still disturbed by it. but in any event, the sound recording is a sped up version of the William Tell Overture, and that is what's been copied here in this particular Trump work, Orange. A query, what is the protectable work of authorship in taking a pre-existing work and speeding it up? Now, maybe there's some unique orchestral sounds that are included and so on and so forth, but it seems to me like you got to filter out all the pre-existing work, which would be the entire William Tell Overture. So I'm not sure what's left, and I could be looking at this from a very simplistic point of view, but I am a little bit troubled that there's been a takedown notice over this. I thought the video was hilarious and got a good chuckle out of it. The thing to me that would be more problematic would be the purported parody with respect to the image of Donald Trump holding the knife through the A-frame or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. You know, I suspect they're probably going to say, look, it's a parody, but it's a parody of what? You know, you're certainly using this pre-existing work, but you're not really commenting or criticizing that particular work. You're kind of using it because it's a rather iconic symbol that people recognize. So
it's really more of a mashup than a parody. It's taking these two things and putting them together, right?
Right, definitely. Definitely. Well, in the similar way in which, again, as I recall from the film, the William Tell Overture was played very quickly, and there were a lot of activity on the scene or on the screen at the same time. So, I would consider this more of like a mashup type of situation.
I would just add one thing, which is that I think the ability to use culture is very important in free speech. So to the founders, the most important kernel of free speech was political speech. Mm-hmm. And if you follow political speech, people make references to media all the time, whether it be, you know, Trump is like the Star Wars, or you're saying, you know, that's just how we communicate. You look at George Orwell in 1984. It's almost difficult to have a sustained political conversation where one of these phrases or references does not come up in popular culture. That's just how we communicate. And so once you start to propertize those things in the context of political speech, it really chills speech in a way that is antithetical to the First Amendment.
Now, I think that's a very fair point, Derek, for sure. I mean, this is pure political speech, and under the First Amendment, that deserves and should deserve the highest protection that's available for expressive content. So it's a definitely well taken point.
The First Amendment, well, we'll see what comes up in this lawsuit if we continue to be able to follow it along and the parties litigate it. But so far, it's just a copyright dispute.
Actually, I ran into this into DMCA takedowns personally this week. It's a relevant story, so permit me an anecdote if I may. I was presenting at a conference in Denmark, a conference of record producers. It's called the Art of Record Production Conference, and it happened to be in Aalborg, Denmark. So I was over there. My collaborator, who is a law scholar here at Boston University, wasn't able to make it. So I was tweaking my presentation and sending her little videos backwards and forwards of the presentation, which contained some references to some of the things we've been talking about, blurred lines, among others. And I had to upload the video to YouTube using an unlisted link in order to send a link to my collaborator to get her to check that I was not talking nonsense from a legal point of view. Mm-hmm. So I was doing this from my hotel room in Denmark over the weekend, and I fired it off to her and got an email back about 5 minutes later. I thought, that's fantastic. She's reviewed that really quickly. Turns out it was an email from YouTube saying, this is a takedown notice. Your YouTube video is no longer available in the US due to a claim by the owners of the copyright of Blurred Lines.
Wow.
So it was the sound recording of Blurred Lines. But the reason I mention it is because, you know, as a foreigner, I'm delighted to live in a country with the First Amendment now that I live in the US. Because as an academic, I comment on things, and fair use thankfully covers academe as much as anything else. But that seems to me as like a fairly straightforward First Amendment example. I'm an academic commenting under my rights in the First Amendment about culture, and a YouTube algorithm that, as Mike says, is not subtle enough on a practical level to nuance or make a judgment, a call just recognizes a digital file and takes down my commentary. So effectively, we have bots already violating the First Amendment, one might say.
Right. Well, that raises a really interesting point, Joe, because at least here in the Ninth Circuit where Denise and I are located, before you can issue a takedown notice, you have to have a good faith belief that the use of the copyrighted material is not protected by fair use. And so I'm not sure what the origination was of that particular notice, if it truly was sent by the rights holder to Blurred Lines, or if it's just an automated type of notice.
No, it was just an automated response saying that we've detected this use of copyrighted audio in this YouTube video, and therefore it may not be available in certain countries.
I see. Okay, so it may not have been an actual takedown notice under the DMCA. It would have been like the Content ID system flagged it and automatically suspended it or something.
Correct, yes. I think that's more likely to be the case.
Got it. Interesting.
It seems like there should be some demarcation between videos that are being uploaded for public view and what Joe was doing here, just trying to share a link with a colleague. Seems like you should get some sort of pass under that situation. But Content ID apparently doesn't make that demarcation. Derek, again, getting back to, you know, the thicket of copyright law and reform, is there any conversation going on that you know of? I mean, certainly there's conversation about copyright law has gotten so broad that it can be used to abridge speech, and this is a bad thing. But is there any sort of step in place or movement in place to try and make explicit this hierarchy that when there is a First Amendment concern involved, that in some circumstances should trump the copyright interest, no pun intended whatsoever?
I don't think there's much of a discussion there. I think no one really wants to touch fair use. You know, I've advocated for years that we need to have more clarification in fair use. So you could easily imagine a statute that did that. But that's not really the course that Congress has taken so far. But you could easily imagine that happening.
Yeah. I'd like to imagine that happening. One thing that is happening, and I think this is something I'd love to touch on with Joe before we move on to some other things and wrap up the show, is the way that technology is changing music and what that should mean for copyright law. We've talked about this before on the show, Joe, and I was happy to see on your site, joebennett.net, that you're paying attention to this too and find it just as fascinating as we do. This whole interactive music creation phenomenon specifically it was something that came up in the video game No Man's Sky with the music in that game being generated on the fly from a limited number of tracks being endlessly remixed real time during gameplay. You have some really interesting posts on your site about this. So there's that phenomenon I flagged. And then the other one is experiencing performances in a different way, whether it's with virtual reality or some sort of first person view that would enable you to have a better experience of the performance. Say you're at a festival like Coachella and there are throngs and throngs of people. And yes, there are huge screens designed to give you a good experience, but what if you could put on goggles and have an even better one? And of course, all of these technological developments lead to different forms of intellectual property. Maybe we could talk about whether the music created by a video game on a fly should be copyrightable or should be something that is just completely outside the realm of copyright. So I'd like to get your take on that, Joe.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult one. If I could begin with the sort of the 10,000 foot view, as you said earlier, that or as we call it in Europe, the 3,000 meter view. It's really how can something as universal as the American Constitution follow technological developments this rapid? How could the founding fathers possibly have taken account of it? And I suppose, just to, as a minor diversion for a moment, the Second Amendment may be an example of that. You know, a law invented in the context of muskets could not have envisioned a world of nuclear weapons. And I suppose a First Amendment law based on verbal speech with no existence of sound recording technology, so the only media would have been verbal speech and written words. How could that world have, how could anyone have envisaged the multiple subtleties of the way we can digitally capture something now? So at that scenario, let's say we have a virtual musician dialing into Coachella, which would create something like a 20 millisecond delay on a very fast internet pipe. Is that a recording? Is that a live broadcast? Is it a live performance? What if somebody holds up their phone and records at that festival that musician playing a cover version and puts the cover version on YouTube? How many rights holders are involved in that transaction and who owns what? Just in a simple scenario like that, that could be generated by any consumer with any of the billions of mobile phones in the world, that scenario alone generates huge copyright challenges. So I don't know. Maybe I don't want to admit defeat, but it seems to me that the movement of the technologies and the multiple permutations of creating copies of things digitally means that the law will always be a little bit behind. And I think this comes from the problem of what copyright is supposed to protect. And just to spend a moment with it semantically, it is the right to copy something. That's what it means. And every computer is a copying machine. The act of browsing the web and going to a URL, it doesn't move something from one place to another. If you go to a URL, you are downloading a copy from the server of the web page that lives on that server, and it is copied locally to your client machine or its web cache. So the RIA ran into this in the early days of MP3s. You know, there was a time when ripping an MP3 was illegal because the act of making the copy for your personal use was itself a copyright violation because you were copying.
Right. Derek, what do you think? Is there a future ahead of us where rights holders can and creators can get paid, but folks can put their phone up and capture the performance at Coachella of a cover of someone else's work, and we don't break the legal system trying to deal with that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the founders weren't expecting for their ideas from the 18th century, their specifics to stay on, which is why the Copyright Act doesn't say books, maps, and charts. They had a statute that said books, maps, and charts, expecting for it to change over time. Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson wanted a specific term limit, and the founders rejected that, not putting a specific number in the Constitution, believing that the length of copyright should change over time based upon different economies, different technologies, et cetera. And so we're always trying to make this balancing act. I mean, that's what the Congress was saying through the 1980s, is that this is a balancing act. The issue is essentially that we've thrown away that balancing act. And now the rhetoric is that, you know, anything that's influenced by that creative work, we should be able to recapture. Well, that's really just a crazy, preposterous notion, particularly in the modern economy where everyone's a content creator, everybody's influencing each other. It's just an impossible thing to do. Now, the reality is that, you know, content creators are making more money now than ever. So it's not necessarily an existential crisis. We just want to figure out how we can, have both of those things coexist. And, you know, somebody filming live at a concert at Coachella, I think this is kind of silly because you're increasing interest in Coachella and that band. And so the artist is probably making money. Every potential profit-making opportunity does not mean that it needs to be illegal. Just because you could ban phones at Coachella doesn't mean that that's necessarily the right copyright policy to have. And we need to kind of recognize that the sky is rising, that it's actually a generally a good thing. There are some people who aren't doing so well in this new economy, and we can take a look at that. But, you know, people being able to film themselves playing Mario Kart or these type of things, that's actually a good mm-hmm. thing. And it's actually creating new forms of creation and innovative unto itself.
Right, and new forms of, you talk about people, how are people going to evolve their livelihoods in the new economy? And one way that people have been evolving their livelihoods is to film themselves playing Mario Kart and build a reputation around their
PewDiePie
expertise.
PewDiePie has 50 million subscribers for
right.
PewDiePie, which is crazy, right? 50 million subscribers to watch him play video games. And so you could say, well, you know, he's stealing from Viacom and Take-Two Interactive and all these companies because he's taking their intellectual – no, that's crazy. You know, no one's going to watch PewDiePie and say, well, now I don't need to buy Call of Duty because I've already seen PewDiePie play it. And so
it has the opposite impact, as I think you brought up earlier, that when you're showcasing somebody else's intellectual property, it tends to increase their sales.
Exactly. And if your perspective is that copyright's a balance, well, then this is just a non-protectable use of that that medium. And that's generally a good thing. But then when we shift to, you know, virtual reality, that's probably, you know, much more copyrightable. We're going to see much more of works that are translated in a copyright medium. This technology is going to be, you know, pretty good for all sides, I think.
Yes. All right, I think we have our first passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is, watch me play Mario Kart. We put these into the show in case you are watching or listening in order to receive MCLE, that's Mandatory Continuing Legal Education credit, or other forms of professional credit perhaps in your jurisdiction. There are some oversight bodies who like to know that you actually watched or listened and have you be able to demonstrate that. Instead of just having you write down the show on a list somewhere. So we put these in so that you can validate that process. We'll put another one in before the end of the show today. Let's wrap up the show talking about, we've already been talking a lot about policy during the show, but let's move on to some other issues in that front. I think Derek, I'd love to talk about, this is a little bit far afield from the copyright issues we've been discussing, but it's something that, you know, in the flurry of coverage of the new administration coming in, has not been getting a lot of coverage, and I know you have some thoughts on it, so why don't you tell us your take on the Time Warner merger and what the new administration means for that and what it means for the rest of us.
So if anybody has been following tech, they've been, you know, aware of the potential of the Time Warner merger. And during the campaign trail, Donald Trump said he was opposed to the Time Warner merger. But we're gonna potentially see. And just to clarify, you know, what we're talking about here is merging with Time Warner Cable on the media side of Time Warner. Mm-hmm. You know, so what experts would call a vertical merger. Mm-hmm. And so that presents really interesting issues. So Donald Trump said that he's opposed to it. But technically speaking, the merger would have to go through the FCC and then has to go through the FTC and ultimately the Attorney General's office. And you know, from an Attorney General perspective, from the FTC's perspective of anti-competitive behavior and merger rules, vertical mergers receive very minimal scrutiny and are generally allowed. And so the main obstacle was seen by experts to be the FCC, but the FCC that's coming in now seems like they're going to be very pro-merger. You know, guys like Ajit Pai. I don't know if he said something publicly on this, but he tends to be much more of that school of thought. And the people that Donald Trump has had on his FCC effort, people like Jeff Ibenock with AEI and Marsha Blackburn also on the FCC transition effort, all of them have said that they support the Time Warner merger. And so, you know, people are increasingly worrying that Trump's words in the campaign trail on Time Warner aren't going to hold up. And, you know, we've seen that in a few other things that Trump campaigned about. And I think his mechanism to kind of get out of that is going to be that the FCC is an independent agency. And so the independent agency will just come to a different conclusion. And so it's going to be interesting to see exactly what that means. There's two things, really. Is one is, does the merger go through? And two is, often mm-hmm. when these mergers go through, they're agreed upon, but they're agreed upon with all sorts of a Christmas tree arrangement. Where the companies agreed to certain behavior, where I think it was Comcast agreed to net neutrality principles, even though it wasn't in the law at that point. And so both of those things are kind of important areas to watch right now.
Okay, we will continue to do so. Can you shed any light on what this means? AT&T and DirecTV are already one, so when Time Warner comes into that, where does it fit?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly how it fits. So we're talking about the Time Warner, the media conglomerate, and AT&T, as in, you know, the broadband side, the telecom side. Mm-hmm. And so there's potential issues that I see, which is, you know, if let's say that you're Google Fiber and you're trying to connect in Chattanooga or a new area across the country. Well, you have to obviously navigate the implications of laying fiber and digging up the road and all sorts of things that go on there, and it's very expensive. But realistically, when you sell fiber to the consumer usually wants internet, they want the ability to have phones, although that's going away, and they want cable. And so in order to be providing broadband in most markets and be competitive, you also have to be able to have cable television. And so we're starting to see monopsony like power, where some of the content holders can really hold the cards and say, well, you know, we'll license this, but only in certain cases if you pay a certain amount of money. And realistically, if the licensing fees are too high, you know, Google can't enter that market, or a different participant, you know, not necessarily Google. And so when you have Time Warner potentially being part of the AT&T conglomerate, their incentive would be to charge more money and to kind of make it more difficult for one of these companies to enter. And so I think that's some of the major issues that that people are going to be keeping an eye on. Now, I think the counterpoint to me is, you know, how powerful is a Time Warner in the modern economy where, you know, you have Netflix and you have Amazon Video and all those participants? But the data seems to show that people buy, you know, fiber or DSL or cable modems with the cable subscription in mind, particularly for real-time news and for real-time sports, ESPN. And so if you control real-time news and you control sports, then you have a lot of influence over you know, broadband deployment in new markets.
Yeah, definitely do. Let's talk about one other legislative piece before we, or proposed legislative piece before we wrap the show here. And this is something that was proposed by Tennessee State Representative Marsha Blackburn to CNN. And since we've been talking about speech-related issues in the copyright context, I think it's worthwhile to bring this up. Derek, you put this in our rundown, and I think it's an interesting proposal that she has that requires, you know, definitely deserves examination and discussion because there are definitely some pros and cons to what's being proposed here. And that is that Ms. Blackburn wants government restrictions on ISPs that puts the onus on them to pull fake news websites offline. I don't know if she has a detailed proposal on that. Maybe you could shed some light for us, Derek.
Yeah, I mean, you got to take these things with a grain of salt because you know, Marsha Blackburn doesn't believe in fair use in a congressional hearing that came up, and so that was kind of a big deal. Even the recording industry was kind of confused by her statement there. But you have to take it seriously because she's, you know, a point person on the Trump transition effort. And, you know, she's on the short list to potentially even be chairwoman of the FCC. And so what she's saying here is that the ISPs themselves should be taking fake news offline. And that's a really disturbing and confusing statement. I mean, I don't know if she means that, you know, websites that that pilfer and fake news would need to get shut down by a Comcast or a, you know, whomever. That's crazy. You know, because who's going to be deciding what are these fake news websites? You know, I think a lot of the websites that have stories that have appeared on InfoWars, for example, have been widely debunked. But does that mean the entire InfoWars website would be banned for 300 million Americans? I mean, that's one of the most more popular websites. I'm not saying our subscribers should necessarily go there, but, you know, they have millions of people. And so I don't think that's necessarily what she means there, but the alternative to banning websites is to ban stories, you know, to actually interfere with the web traffic and, you know, X out on articles or stories or links. That's even more crazy because that also wouldn't work. That would really break the internet. And it really sounds kind of like SOPA and PIPA on steroids. I mean, this is further than SOPA and PIPA would have gone. And the natural implication is if you can do this to get rid of fake news stories, of course you would also want to do this to get rid of piracy. I mean, if you're going to do this, you may as well also go after piracy and child pornography and terror. I mean, why would you limit your options?
Right.
And it's kind of funny. It reminds me a lot of the, you know, the fairness doctrine from the 1980s, which, you know, conservatives, including Marsha Blackburn, have been against. So I really have no way to interpret this logically.
Right. And where my brain went is just as we don't want YouTube and Google trying to sort out whether an infringement is taking place. Now, we've been critiquing the content ID system, but at least the DMCA takes them out of the decision loop. I definitely would want ISPs out of that loop in this kind of situation as well, that they're trying to make a qualitative decision about what's fake and what's not and what gets to be online and what's not. As you say, it's shades of SOPA and PIPA and not in a good way. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Yes, it's nuts.
There we go. Very succinctly put. Love it. All right. Speaking of nuts, we have not yet provided you with our animal selfie of the week, which frequently involves squirrels, but not this time. Right. I got to meet that little raccoon last week in person. It was meaningful for me. All right, our animal selfie of the week has some copyright overtones, involving, as it does, Mickey Mouse. So this is one of those restaurants at a Disney park. I'm not sure which one, although I've been to one that looks just like this. So it could be the one here in Anaheim. And Mickey has taken the camera and is romping about, much like real animals do when they take animal selfies, capturing himself and various individuals in the restaurant and various other characters there joining the diners. So just to add another shade to our ongoing animal selfie discussion, what happens when the animal is not actually an animal and takes a selfie. Let us move on. We have a couple of tips and resources for you to round out the show. The two tips for the week are, and again, this is something that Derek flagged that I saw in, I think, your Twitter stream, Derek, that we have a list that was put together. Let's see. Do you remember who put together the list, Derek?
I put together the list.
This is a list you did? The binder full of techies list? Wow. Yes. Good for you. I saw Garrett Johnson had posted it. So I did not know this was actually your list. This is awesome.
I worked with Lincoln Network, so it was, you know, a team effort, of course. But Lincoln Network put it out, and it's an assembly of all the positions, tech and digital positions, in the Trump administration.
Oh, that's fantastic. So our tip is to please, please review this list. If you are a person in the technological digital arena, and see if any of this might work for you, because I would definitely love to know that folks who watch and or listen to Twitch shows are having an active role in the governing of our country. Tell us, I mean, obviously it's a great idea to put together this list. Derek, is there any detail or context you want to give us here?
Well, first I want to thank our intern. He pulled all those positions. There was a lot of work going through the plum book. But there's a lot of digital and tech positions in the White House and all the agencies. And, you know, there's not necessarily enough people to go around. So it's a good opportunity, I think, to apply if you are interested. I think we need as many tech people as possible, or digital people, or copyright people as possible in the loop. You know, nearly every agency has a CTO and a staff of people like that. There's the USPTO, there's the Library of Congress that has a few positions, and there's the US Digital Service that has a few positions. So I know that they're looking for strong candidates.
That's fantastic. Good work putting that together. I hope folks will check it out. Our other tip of the week is that the Slants, who we've discussed much on the show, the band who have a trademark dispute that will be before the Supreme Court as to whether they can call themselves the Slant, yet another First Amendment issue in our show here today. They are going to be heard by the Supreme Court, and they are raising money to help support their efforts in going forward. Litigating at that level is no easy or cheap matter. So if you're interested in helping them out, if you think the Slants should be able to call themselves the Slants, and you think the law should develop in the way that they are arguing it should develop, go check out their generosity.com funding page and do what you can. So our resources of the week, actually it's one resource of the week, and it is the Library Innovation Lab at Harvard's Case Law Access Project. This is something that has been ongoing for a while now. They are digitizing and making searchable some 40 million pages from 43,000 case law books in the library's collection. So if you are a law buff, if you are looking for access to legal research materials and the actual case law itself, the Case Law Access Project is something you're definitely going to want to check out, and a very good public service from the folks at Harvard. Guys, this has been a really, really fun show, entertaining show, interesting show. I've really enjoyed spending this time with you, Derek. It's great to see you again after way too long a gap. I hope everything's going great with you. Is there anything you want to plug or mention before we go ahead and sign off today?
Nope, just thanks for having me on.
It's Great to see you again. Joe, so nice meeting you. Thank you for all of your insights and thoughts on the thorny issues of music copyright.
Well, thank you for hosting. You've been terrific. I've really enjoyed my time here.
We've really enjoyed having you. Is there anything going on at the Boston Conservatory at Berkeley that we should be aware of before you sign off today?
Well, it's a question of which day there isn't anything going on. If you Google Boston Conservatory events, you will see our huge calendar. You know, and basically any night of the week you're in Boston, there is always something musical to see.
That's so wonderful. It's so great to meet you, and we really appreciate your taking the time. And Mike, I really appreciate your suggesting that we have Joe on the show.
I'm so thrilled that Joe and Derek were both able to make it today. This was a great discussion and very thought-provoking. So we really appreciate both of you being here with us.
Yes, we really do. And we really appreciate all of our audience for joining us today. If you've joined us live, starting at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. That means you've been watching us, warts and all, as we record the show live before it's been edited and put out. We do record the show every week at that time on Fridays. It's really fun to have a live audience. We hope that you can join us live. You know, if you can take the time and do that, that's great. But if you can't, don't worry about it. The show is there for you on your schedule whenever you would like. If you go to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there, along with various ways in which you can enjoy the show on whatever device you please. So we're just thrilled that you do join us, that you participate either in IRC or get in touch with us between the shows. You can email Mike. He's mike@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. If you want to give some heads up to Emery of something, he's emery@twit.tv. The show has a Facebook page and a Google Plus page. If you'd like to converse with us in more long form than Twitter permits, it is This Week in Law at Twitter. But that is really more sort of a channel we use to distribute the shows and provide, you know, minimal information about the shows. If you're going to get in touch with us about people that you would like us to talk to or direct feedback on the shows, either email us or give us an @ on Twitter, and that will help us see it more quickly. You can reach out to either me or Mike or Emery. We love hearing from you. Thank you so much for doing that for us. We love getting your thoughts and suggestions on the show. Our last show of the year will be next week before we go ahead and take a holiday break. We hope that you'll join us for that. And we're really glad that you've been able to take part today on This Week in Law. Take care.